This is P.S. You're Wrong, the podcast where you talk trash about the things people love to hate and hate to love, and we're your hosts, Shelby and Matt.
Back with another pop culture roundup for the fans. Two weeks in a row, we're setting records.
I know. We're looking down the barrel of the podcast mic into our listeners.
Yes. We got a text last week saying thank you for doing a pop culture roundup. So, you know, the people are desperate, as it turns out.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I mean, we have all the important stuff. I think we cover it with great detail, i.e. everyone who listened last week knows more about Diddy. So, check.
Well, did you see the new information released on that case?
No. You know, I saw the headline as I was preparing for this, and I was like, I should read this, and then I couldn't bring myself to bother.
Yeah, so, I guess that there's just these, like, lawsuits that are rolling out, so there's just, like, lots and lots of, information, and there's, like, a blind item sort of lawsuit, which I don't know exactly how it works legally, but there are claims that Diddy raped a 13-year-old girl at a 2000 VMA after party, which is heinous enough as it is. But then there's this blind item that said another male celebrity also did that while a female celebrity watched on. So,
yeah, yikes.
Presumably at some point, the identities of these other two celebrities are going to come out, and then there'll be people, like, rather than people just being sort of like loosely linked to Diddy, that'll be like actually linked to him. So I didn't see anything about who these people might be. I'm sure that people are now combing through like photos from the 2000 VMA after party to figure out who this possibly could be. But yeah, bleak.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's not a fun story. So should we still tell the other non-fun story? Get it out of the way. I mean,
yes, all respect. Yes, let's go.
Okay. So Liam Payne died, which is pretty shocking. I mean, very shocking. I was never a One Directioner, but I saw the headline and I was like, what? He's like younger than me. It's just so weird when someone, obviously when anyone dies, and especially any sort of star power, but like when it's someone young, you're just like, it just feels like everything stops for a second and you're like, wait, what? This doesn't make any sense. And it's such a, you know, it's just like a horrific accident or kind of a tangled web, and everyone's still sort of sorting out the details. But basically he was in Argentina. In fact, he attended one of the other Directioners concert down there. And then the day it happened, the hotel called the police and was like, we have a guest who's destroying the furniture in his room. He's having some sort of episode. He's on drugs. He's drunk or something. Like, we're worried for his life. Please come. And then before they could get there, he fell off of his third story balcony and was pronounced dead at the scene. And I don't know. It was just like so sad. And of course it's tragic too, because he has a little kid, a little boy, and obviously all the celebrities are shocked too. So you have all these like revisiting of moments, especially among the other Directioners and Simon Cowell and all of that. So I don't know. How did you feel about it?
I mean, I was working at the time, and you know, it like came in our breaking news feed that it had happened. And yeah, I was just like in shock. I don't have super strong like One Direction sort of connections myself. My sister was like a massive, massive, massive fan. So it's like, I know who they all are. I know their songs. Like I know them in a more like in-depth way than I do a lot of pop stars, just because of her sort of obsession. He like obviously I think has sort of been the one who's seemed to be the most troubled since the band's breakup. Yeah. Like, you know, Zayn obviously left first and has sort of had his whole thing with Gigi Hadid and that plot line. And then Harry and Niall, I think, have been sort of the most successful after this. Louis, I don't think, has really done very much, but has sort of been out of the public eye and a lot. Where Liam has had some, you know, sort of like unsavory things he said and done. And he like recently had all of this press because he had something or another done with his face and his face looked different. So, yeah, I feel like he's been sort of troubled-esque for a bit, but I definitely didn't, you know, obviously think that this would happen or want this to happen. So I was very surprised. Yeah. And then, yeah, since then, it's just sort of been a slow sort of investigation onto what actually happened. And yeah, I think it's sort of hard to say exactly.
Yeah.
Which is,
yeah, sad. I mean, TMZ remains the worst. They like released photos of the body. And then quickly deleted it when people called them out. But it's just like, it's just wild the way, I mean, yeah, it's just all media coverage around celebrity especially is usually exploitative. But that's just like a pretty established line, you know, to not cross just for clicks. But TMZ has got a TMZ, I guess.
Yeah, it's very disturbing because then we in our newsroom were having to figure out what to do with that because it's sort of like, okay, like, do we publish a story on TMZ leaking these photos or does that make it worse because then more people know that the photos were released at some point? Like, how does one sort of navigate that? And luckily, I'm not on the trending news team, so I didn't really have to deal with it. But it was, yeah, there was a lot of discussion on all of that kind of stuff. And I think whenever there's a celebrity death that's like a big person, it's sort of like, okay, to what extent do you cover it as news? Right. To what extent is it a tribute? To what extent is it sort of like ambulance chaser sort of energy? Like, how do you navigate that line? So tricky.
Well, as a journalist, okay, I understand having like obits ready for like 50 and up, you know, but is it like anytime someone becomes famous, it's like, okay, someone just pencil a quick obit,
I guess it sort of depends like on where you are. Like, I think the New York Times has a whole like obituary department or a couple people who write those. So I'm sure that they have them ready for lots of big named celebrities. You know, like I'm sure that they have a Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, a Jennifer, like all of those locked and loaded just in case something happens. Like we we have some of them pre-written for, you know, like we have a Jimmy Carter, we have a Jane Fonda, you know, like those kind of people. But then, like with this, somebody had to sort of just jump on and try to write it quickly. So, yeah, it's
very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think I also heard, I've heard like tale or rumor of like that celebrity PR people will sort of like write them themselves, you know, like big name celebrities will sort of like write their own obituaries or their teams will have written them to sort of vet it. And I don't know who is getting that or whatever, but that they just have that sort of launched. Like I don't know exactly, but I have heard about that. So interesting.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I mean, I feel like that's I think they should make a movie. Maybe it's like Minority Report, but it's just someone who like writes these obits for fun, and then one of them turns out to like predict the actual way the celebrity dies, and then they get in trouble and they have to go on the run. I think that's a movie waiting to happen.
There's definitely some movie or another where there is a character whose job is to write obituaries. I'm like, I know that's like, it's not 500 Days of Summer because he's a greeting card writer, but there's a movie that's something like that, that's an obituary writer. That's a quirky job. But I don't think that it is I don't think it's a fortune telling kind of thing. Well, then there's also the John Green book where one of the characters is obsessed with people's last words. That's like one of his manic dream people's obsession.
Yeah, but I want the story to be about
writing
a thriller. Obituary that hasn't happened yet. Mm-hmm. I think that's the $1 million idea right there. Mm-hmm. Okay, so can we talk about my favorite story of the week?
Yes, go for it.
Okay, so
is it wait, can I guess what it is?
Yeah, I mean, I think
is it
you
Cynthia
know.
Erivo? Yeah. Oh my gosh, it's so funny.
Yeah, it's just okay. So Cynthia
this
Erivo
is the wildest, most offensive thing so I have seen.
It's offensive how offended she was. So she's the star of Wicked, aka Elphaba, but. There's so many layers to this that I found interesting, but facts up front, they had sort of a homage to the original Broadway poster that they released a bit ago that has both actresses on the screen, and it's different than the playbill, like iconic illustration part. And so a little fan, like, you know, just a random person on TikTok or Instagram or whatever it is, just was like, oh, changing the movie poster to match the Broadway poster. So she lowered the hat to cover Cynthia Erivo's eyes, changed the lips to red, and kind of like shadowed it more to dramatically increase the lack of facial features that are placeable, right? So essentially erased. I mean, it was such a non-thing. I literally saw this before Cynthia Erivo responded. So I saw it and I was like, yeah, it's not actually like that great of a Photoshop job, but like, yeah, cool. Congrats. It wasn't even commentary. This wasn't like Sonic the Hedgehog or something where they're like memeing a bad poster and being like, this is absolute shit. Like, try again. Thank you very much. It was just like a fun thing that this fan did and it went viral. And so Cynthia Erivo sees it, and I guess she hasn't been on the internet long because she says, this is the wildest, most offensive thing I have seen. And
you have to.
And I don't want to diminish her feelings, but she really doubles down on this and is like, this is like, deep. It erases me. This is deeply hurtful. Wait, and that's fair. No, you can, like, feel that way.
I'm like, I actually have to read the entirety of this post because it is so
go through
wild.
Word for word.
And it is like, I've read this like 40 times. I'm just like fascinated.
I love it.
Like, what would possess a, you know, Tony winning, Grammy winning, Emmy winning actress to write this? She says, this is the wildest, most offensive thing I have seen. Equal to that awful AI of us fighting. Equal to people posing the question, is your pussy green? None of this is funny. None of it is cute. It degrades me. It degrades us. The original poster is an illustration, all caps. I am a real life human being who chose to look right down the barrel of the camera to you, the viewer, because without words, we communicate with our eyes. Our poster is an homage, not an imitation. To edit my face and hide my eyes is to erase me, and that is just deeply hurtful. Like, wild. Wild. Because the thing she's referencing also in this post, so she, like, you know, screenshots or whatever, the edited version of her poster to make it look more like the original Broadway poster. But then she's also referencing this AI thing that's like somebody gave AI the prompt to like make it look like the two of them were fighting. So it's like Ariana Grande sort of whispers in Cynthia Erivo's ear and then like they turn around and it's very clearly like CGI of the two sort of wrestling. It's like a 2 second clip maybe, like,
yeah,
whatever. And then the is your pussy green is a reference to somebody wrote on the old like subway poster. This is like 10 years ago of the like the original Broadway poster. Since Glinda is whispering into Elphaba's ear, wrote on the poster, "Is your pussy green?" Like that's what she's whispering. And so that like was a meme forever ago, like a long before the Wicked movie even was like a thought.
Yeah.
And somehow or another got like re-promoted or whatever during this press cycle. Like people brought it back up out of the bowels of the internet and were like, "Hey, remember when this thing happened?" So it's like the fact that she's going off about a how offensive it is when it's like this was written on a poster before you were ever even cast in Elphaba, before you were ever even cast in most things in your career. Like it's shocking how offensive she took this to be. And then on a red carpet they asked Ariana Grande like, "Hey, so like
what are your thoughts?"
She sort of had to give this like weird mealy mouthed answer that was like, well, clearly like
she's like, "Oh, fans make little edits, you know," like it's like she focused on the AI element of like, I think AI is dangerous type thing. But this was just a fan doing this poster. So it is very funny. I mean, very odd. And it's like, again, Cynthia can feel sad, but it wasn't even like, you know, it'd be one thing if it was like, "Oh, I hate Cynthia Erivo's casting. Like, let's do a poster as if Kristen Chenoweth and Idina Menzel were back as our beauty queens." You know, it was like, this wasn't at all critical of Cynthia. And so for Cynthia Erivo to take it so personally and then to viciously like turn it on, one, this little artist who did this for fun, but two, to sort of like appear so out of touch that on the internet, she can say with her full chest that this is the worst thing she's seen on the internet. Like, it's like, girl, like not on my internet. Like, you know, like this is child's play. And, yeah, I think it goes back to what we talked about last week, where it's like maybe celebrities shouldn't have access to their own their own socials without having a screening team, because it just felt like such a crazy overreaction that it almost felt like this has to be staged somehow. Like this has to be staged, but I don't think it is. And I think if I were to psychoanalyze for a moment, I think it really comes down to the fact that so much of this press has been around Ariana and her Glinda, and everyone's been hyping up that. Like, I've only seen really a lot of Ariana content, a lot of Ariana, you know, interviews. And there were rumors that they didn't get along on set at first, and like they're both divas or whatever. But I think there's sort of this like fear of not being like the main character, which I think that will be righted in a movie that's all about Elphaba and where Cynthia Erivo has the better voice, IMHO. But I think that had to play into it where she felt erased again. Like she was like, "This is my last straw. Okay. Like I needed people to see that I was on this movie poster, goddammit." And she's just like, I can't do it anymore. This is deeply hurtful and I need to speak my truth.
Yeah, it does just go back to the thing of like celebrities, I think, are like offline, like they're not online enough, I think. It's like they either need to be less online or more online. Like clearly Cynthia is not online enough to know that these are like jokes and, you know, that nobody cares and whatever. But then she's also too on, like she's so online that she is commenting about it. It's like, she's not like a recluse who has no idea what's going on. Like somehow or another, this trickled down to her and she was not pleased. I think that, but I'm sort of like, Cynthia, the reason why you are not getting this press as much press in this lead up is because early on, everybody was like, "Yeah, Cynthia Erivo, great singer, like perfectly fine casting for this role. Ariana Grande, do we think she can act? Like, is she?" I feel like people were really going after Ariana when the casting was announced. And so now that we're getting closer and people have seen it and, you know, we're getting, you know, drips and drabs of like, "Oh no, it's actually a good movie and Ariana Grande is really good in it." It's like, it's more just writing that wrong. It's not saying, "Oh, Ariana Grande like blows Cynthia Erivo out of the water. Like Cynthia Erivo could never." It's saying like, "Oh, remember when we all thought Ariana Grande was bad casting for this movie? Well, turns out maybe we were wrong and that maybe she's actually good in it." And I'm just, I'm like, some of these artist people are like so sensitive, but I feel like you have to have like a Lady Gaga mentality when you're going through this. You know what I mean? Like, you can take it as seriously as you want to take it, but like, you have to realize that there's people on the internet who are going to say weird things, and you just have to kind of roll with it and be like, okay, yeah, sure, fine, whatever. Like, I'm not going to get distracted.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was a definite choice. And at first, the original creator deleted her video because I'm sure they were just like terrified and shocked to be put on blast. And then they came back and was like, no, I've decided to repost. And like, she can feel how she wants, but I really wasn't trying to hurt her feelings. And like, this is just a fun homage. So yeah, Cynthia has yet to respond.
Some other fun stories for this week. Have you been following the Apple tour videos of on the Brat tour? Have you followed this plotline at
seen,
all?
Yeah, I've seen some of them.
Okay, so there's a section during, well, okay, so Apple is obviously a song that is on Charlie XCX's album Brat. There is a TikTok dance that goes with it. That's pretty easy, that basically everybody has done. It's been around the internet for a while at this point. And so during the concert, there's a section where she's like, where she picked, or her team, like, you know, find somebody out of the audience and they sort of do the dance on camera and it's projected up onto the big screen. And usually it's like the main person and then there's some other people who are around it and everybody's kind of doing the dance together.
Great. Yeah.
This first sort of made news, I guess, at the New York one, where they got the girl who originally created the Apple dance to perform it. And then this other random woman, like out of nowhere, like try to jump in the shot and like grab the girl's arm. And for me, like being there, I didn't notice any of this, but then watching the footage later, you just see sort of like what a pro the main girl is for just like continuing on, even though this other person is like losing their mind next to them.
Yeah.
So that all happened and, you know, great, whatever. We've moved on. They do this every concert and sometimes the videos are really fun. Sometimes, you know, somebody sort of flubs a thing. It's whatever. But then in LA, first, Charlie, like, called out the LA audience for not, like, knowing the words to her songs and not, like, dancing enough. She was basically saying,
oh,
like,
really?
All these influencers are here. Like, you guys bought these tickets because you thought it was cool, but you actually aren't fans. Like, you're fake fans. Because the song, the Iconopop song came on, which is, like, even a deep cut Charlie XCX reference. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like that's a pretty mainstream song.
Yeah.
And like, nobody, I guess, knew it and was dancing. And so she sort of, like, stopped in the middle of the song and was like, are you guys for real? Like, get it together. And then, during the Apple dance, you know, they got somebody or another to be the main person. And then all of these influencers are behind her, including Brittany Broski, the kombucha girl.
And
a clip of her, you know, just sort of doing the dance. And then out of nowhere, this random man like bulldozes into her, knocks her over and starts doing the dance again. It's
completely
like LA is a terror. Like, all of these social media people are just, like, so desperate to be cool that they're, like, clawing all over each other. Yeah, it's wild. So funny. but, yeah, there's a good article on the Vulture that is all of the Apple videos. So you can just, like, watch the TikToks from every single one of them. And some of the people are really great and some of the people are whatever. But that one is very funny, the LA people.
Has Brittany said anything about it?
I don't know. Not that I have seen, but it is.
Yeah, it's pretty.
See if I can find anything.
I mean, man,
but it
am
is
I right?
So funny. Yeah. Well, and it's clearly like some gay guy in like in like a mesh like
leather or something,
jersey something or another. Yeah. And he's like older too. It's not like a 22 year old. Like, this is like a full grown man who's probably like close to 40, if not. wild stuff. Do you have any other news? Taylor Swift loves Dave Portnoy. Do you want to defend your girl on that front?
Who is that?
The you haven't seen this story? This is...
I don't remember.
So Dave Portnoy is the guy who owns Barstool Sports, who's been like accused of various things. And apparently he's like a big Taylor Swift fan and like has, you know, gone on record, like on his podcast or whatever, like supporting her and saying what a big fan he is. And then she wrote some like very nice like handwritten letter to him when he came to the concert that was like, oh my gosh, I'm so glad that you're here, like thanks for always defending me, blah blah blah. And so now people are online are like, oh gosh, like really, of all the people that you could be sending nice notes to, you're sending it to this person? And it's clearly just because like he's a Swiftie and not like, you know, not that he does like good things. Like you're more,
it's funny,
obsessed with people who like you rather than who are good people.
Yeah.
Anywho,
I did see something interesting about Taylor Swift where it's like the British people have been asking why she had such intense VIP level security while she was doing her last Wembley shows, like after the terrorist scare. And like, this is like levels of security that is something that wouldn't even be given to like Harry and Meghan, you know, like it was like an intense part. And because of that, it's like paid for by the British people, right? Because it's like the royal guard or whatever. And so they've had to like justify that. And I guess it's kind of a tangled web because her manager was like, if you don't provide this level of security, we are going to cancel these shows. And on top of that, the officials on the UK team who advocated for breaking this protocol, this pretty strict, like historic protocol of who gets what in the, you know, royal family of protection, they all ended up getting free tickets to multiple shows. And so it was, I mean, it's like, you know what? She wanted her security. She got her security. It didn't like... It was security officers who were being paid either way, you know. It didn't necessarily break the bank for the British royalty. But it is kind of funny that that's her level of fame at this point, is that she got the king to bow down to her, basically, and ensure that she would still show up for these shows by laying out this royal red carpet and saying, okay, yeah, you can get this very elite benefit, and hopefully it doesn't come to bite us in the ass later. So
I guess,
yeah, I guess she can afford to.
As to why she isn't like, as a private citizen, you are responsible for your own security. Like, it's not like the,
I think
US
the terrorism aspect, like,
I mean, okay. Yeah, but sure. Like,
I think that like changed it.
And I guess maybe there's police and stuff at like a regular US Taylor Swift concert.
Yeah.
But it does sort of feel like, I don't know, that like if you want more security, like you like you're in charge of getting that. Like I wouldn't even there's a certain level of like entitlement to even like ask for that kind of a thing, you know? Like to be like,
well,
oh,
I wonder,
no,
like
I want
the rules, right? Like I doubt she could hire like a ex Navy SEAL team to come in and like protect her with guns and like, you know, whatever it is that would make her feel safe.
Did they have like guns at the concert? Like,
I don't remember how it works. Like, I think it was part of the getting to and from. So it wasn't necessarily like at the venue. It was more the pre-show sort of situation, like getting Taylor to where she needed to be and feeling safe and whatever. So I think like finding the hotels and securing the venues in that regard for like her safety in particular. But yeah, I don't know like the rules of, you know, this allyship between the US and the UK, where maybe it is. Yeah, because if an artist comes here, I think there's always police at concerts or whatever. I have no idea the inner machinations of political give and take between nations, but yeah, no, she does. There was definitely a entitlement, at least in saying like, this is my line, like take it or leave it. And they took it. So all hell to Taylor Swift.
I guess just to go to more general Taylor Swift news. This is the last leg of the tour that she's on currently that's in the U.S.?
Yeah.
Is there another? Yeah. Or is there another one? Is she going someplace else after this or no?
Oh, so she has a couple of weekends in, like, I think she did the Florida. And then I want to say somewhere else on the East Coast. Like, she's not coming back to L.A., but then she goes to Canada. And Canada will be her last shows.
Okay. Okay. So but that's all this fall still.
Yeah. Yeah. So it'll be done by the end of the year.
Weeks. Okay.
Yeah.
And then she still has two of the re-releases coming.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
So is the
going wisdom that one of those will be happening here soon?
Well, yeah. So she famously she's changed, like, every costume has had multiples, like every era on her tour has had multiple costume changes or like shifts or different colored outfits she'll trot out, except for Reputation. Reputation has been the one single same outfit the entire tour. And so people were like, oh, when she changes that, that's when we'll know, like, Reputation Taylor's version is coming out. Cause she did the same thing with when Speak Now came out, she switched her Speak Now era dress. And when 1989 came out, she changed all the eras to blue to represent, like, the blue album cover of 1989. And so there has been this historic trend of her using costume changes to then highlight a big announcement to come out that night. So she changed her Reputation outfit on the opening night of this tour leg. But she didn't make any sort of announcement about Reputation. So now there's a lot of, like, you know, mathematics and Easter egg guesses and equations being thrown that, well, she's going to say something at this date for a release on December 13th, her birthday, and it'll be a whole thing. And it's like she got her reputation back on her birth, whatever, her rebirth type thing. At this point, it's like, I don't know, because I think she is chasing numbers. So scratch any idea of her just, like, blind dropping these. She's never going to do a blind drop again because she'll want the promo to build up to a release to then add to her records of, like, number weeks on number one and how many albums have gotten these, you know, whatever. She's right. Strategizing. And so to me, it's like, I think we'll probably get one before end of year, but I think she'd give us a heads up. So she's sort of running out of time. Oh, but the other interesting thing about Taylor Swift that I think you'll like is this whole tour book she's doing, right? Have you seen this story?
No. Mm-mm. She's writing a book.
She's releasing like a coffee book style, like, collection of photos from the tour. So backstage, okay, on stage, the whole length of the tour. And it's like 250 pages and it's being sold through Target. But then, like, different publishers or different publishing experts have realized that there's no, like, ISBN number associated with this book. And she did not go through any of the normal publishers for this book. Like, it wasn't a deal. It's self-published, but it's also not self-published in a traditional way where you're granted an ISBN number. And that becomes sort of the trackable system for ending up in other retailers or, you know, getting on in libraries or whatever. So this is instead going to be published by her through Target exclusively. So it's like a merchandise item instead of an actual book. And I mean, again, that's just like she's rattling pretty established structures, sort of similar to how she did her Eras Tour movie, self-financed and then self, you know, released through AMC. And so some people are like, oh shit, like, this is going to make other people think they can do the same thing. And it, like, really only benefits the retailer and the artist, aka Taylor Swift's pockets and Targets, because it can be probably taxed or measured in a different way because it's not an actual book. And it's, you know, she cuts out every single middleman she can think of. So I don't know. It'll be curious to see how that shakes out. And, like, you know, having a Target exclusive doesn't do anything to help her image of being one for the people. So it's fine.
Also, it is weird because on one hand, like, yeah, sure, it's a Target exclusive. So you're like, she's making more money probably off every copy because she is not going through Penguin Random House and whoever, like whatever their, you know, paper person is and all of that kind of stuff. But at the same time, if it's a Target exclusive, then it's only going to be sold in Target, which I think does limit you in a lot of ways, because one, there's places where Target, where there aren't Targets, or people who like don't necessarily shop there. But then also just like, I think one, like part of how books sell in general, especially like coffee table type books, is by people like seeing them, perusing them, and sort of doing impulse kind of buys. And so the more places you have that book available, the more likely someone is to be like, oh, my granddaughter loves Taylor Swift, let me buy this book. And if you're only in Target and you're not on Amazon and you're not in Barnes and Noble and you're not at indie bookstores and you're not at like, you know, like little gift shop places, I think that does impact like the number of points. I mean, I'm sure that she's had a team who's like ran the numbers on this and figured out that this is the to do it and to make the most money, but it is interesting. But that, but the coffee table book does not tie into any record or like album related stuff, I guess. Interesting.
I mean, I guess it'll feature some of the re-recordings she released while on tour,
okay?
Because she like shared the music video for Speak Now and whatever.
So then, okay, so she's So people are thinking that it's most likely that she will release Reputation before the debut one. Debut. So then she'll end with sort of like end where you start kind of a vibe.
I think so. I think the costume is the main. I think she's been wearing more like snakes. And so people are like Reputation and, you know, even that like horrendous velvet number and like. She's just, I think that's people's general Easter egg hunt conclusion.
And but so we think that those are probably coming out like some, like one of them's coming out the end of this year and then something, and then the other one will presumably come out like sometime next year and then we're done with this and she's back to regular albums.
Yeah, I mean, that's the idea, but it's also like she loves milking, you know, this time and era. So I would assume one comes out this year, but I also wouldn't be surprised if she's like, I'm going to put the eras to bed and then open the year with a big old re-recording Lollapalooza. Oh, no. I mean, maybe. Who knows with her? She's just so inspired all the time. But
well, because I do feel like it's the eras tour. She's re-releasing this stuff. Like, it makes sense for her to release both of these like from an artistic standpoint before like moving into whatever the next new album is, but I guess you could have said that with Dead Poets Society and yet here we still are, so
so
interesting.
I'll keep you posted.
Okay, well, should we get into Love It or Hate It now that we've spent too much time talking about Taylor Swift? Please. I would like to talk about the movie Anora, which I believe came out this weekend in some places. It will be coming out other places at other times. I'm not exactly sure how the rollout is working for this, but it is one of my favorite movies of the year. It's directed by Sean Baker, who did The Florida Project and Tangerine, which are two of my favorite movies. He also did Simon Rex a couple of years ago, which I didn't like as much, but whatever. And Anora came out at Cannes this past summer. It won the top prize there. Then it has proceeded to play a bunch of these other festivals. It's really gotten like nothing but incredible reviews. It stars Mikey Madison, who I think you would probably recognize from the Scream 5, I think. Yeah, Scream 5. She's one of the people. I think she's actually one of the bad guys who gets killed at the end. But anyways, she's in that. And in this movie, she plays a stripper who lives in New York. And she, you know, is like going to work or whatever. And she meets this young guy who is like the son of a Russian oligarch. So he has like loads and loads and loads of money, but like isn't really doing anything. He sort of becomes infatuated with her. He invites her to things. They become friends. And, you know, he's like paying her to sleep with him, but then they kind of form this like friendship, romance, and he asks her to marry him, so they get married, and she, you know, therefore would become the heir or have access to all of his like money. And his parents are not excited about that. So these Russian parents are like, wait, we have to put a stop to this. And then you get this sort of hijinks movie where it's like they're kind of on the run and people are chasing them and they're trying to get them to get a divorce so that they can get the money back. And it's a lot of fun and it's a comedy in a lot of ways, but there's also like sort of a darker undertone that really comes out at the end, and the acting's really good, and it's just sort of a fun romp of a movie. And I think it does something interesting, which is like it shows sex work as like not, you know, obviously not like a great fun field to be in, but I think in a way that is accurate and in a way that is like sort of sad but also humanizing and like funny at the same time. And apparently they've done a lot of screenings for you know, people who like, it was shot at an actual gentleman's club here in New York. Like, it involves a lot of their dancers. Their dancers like taught the girl in the movie how to do it, and so it's people in the community have been very pleased with how it's sort of portrayed. And yeah, it's just really it's really fun. I really liked it. I don't know anybody who has not liked it. I'm sure that those reviews are coming because, you know, such is how backlash works. But yeah, it's really great.
I would have never guessed that's what it was about.
What did you think it was about, or didn't you know?
Well, it's just like I only see like the snippet trailer on like TikTok ads or Instagram where it's just kind of, it seems sort of moody. And I don't know. I guess I would have expected something more like, I don't, what was the one about the dad and his daughter's last like weekend at the resort?
Oh, After Sun?
Before he died.
Yeah.
Yeah, like sort of like sort of indie, I don't know, kind of just cerebral almost.
No, this is like pretty funny because she's like real mouthy, and then you sort of have these like the Russian parents like call these people who like, you know, are sort of like supposed to be taking care of their son, but who just like live in Brooklyn, like these just random like old Russian men. And so they're kind of bumbling and like trying to chase them, and they're trying to figure out where people are. And yeah, there's some like chase scenes and fight scenes and stuff that are pretty entertaining. It's it's a romp of a movie, I would say. Lots of swearing and lots of nudity. So don't necessarily take your parents to it, but good times.
Good to know. Less fun, but good. I watched Woman of the Hour, which is Anna Kendrick's directorial debut. It just came out on Netflix. It follows the story. It's like inspired by this real life, or it is about this real life serial killer who ended up on a dating show in the 70s, and like won a date with the contestant who was played by Anna Kendrick. Have you heard about it at all?
Yes, this played at Toronto, not this year, but last year, but I still haven't seen it.
Yeah, no, it just came out on Netflix and it's very good. It was, I didn't expect much because frankly, a lot of actors direct and it's like whatever, but I think she had some really compelling and interesting choices, not only in how it was storyboarded, like it's sort of told non-linearly, and obviously serial killer movies can kind of be hit or miss in that they might over glamorize the serial killer themselves or over romanticize it or use like real shock value to exploit the horror of the moments. But this was really delicately handled, I think. Like, he murders a lot of women and you see a lot of the attacks on screen, so obvious trigger warning, but it's never like, you know, oh, let's watch him rape her now, or even explicitly showing the violence. It's a lot of suggestion and distracted camera angles and all of that. And it just builds a really interesting tension and fear where it focuses on all these women and how there are systems in place that just continue to fail them, whether it's people who think women are being hysterical and they're nervousness around this guy, or police are just like straight up ignoring tips, or, you know, like this guy had a history of literal arrests, spent jail time for raping a child, and was still cast on this show. Like, you know, like just like this symptom of a larger issue where misogyny fuels this kind of violence and allows that kind of violence to thrive, and like how these women, and especially with the gender politics of like nicety and politeness, like there's so much, oh, like dancing around your feelings of fear to try and like not make a scene. And so I thought it was really good. It moves fast. It's interesting. It's heavy. It's very sad. But ultimately, it focuses on the victims and the survivors in a way that felt like interesting and worth having another, yet another serial killer story out there. And she, as a director, I think made interesting choices, like I said, where she, yeah, I think it made me respect her kind of more as someone who like is thoughtful about what story she's trying to tell and what she doesn't want to do. So she like purposely made the serial killer less attractive than he was in real life, just because she didn't want that to be the thing of like, oh, Zac Efron's playing serial killer, you know? So anyways, it was a good but heavy watch. So I'll be interested to see what she does next.
Yeah, it's on my list of things to watch by the end of the year, because I do think I have heard that it is very good. And yeah, I'm interested to see what she does next as well. When it played at Toronto, so it was in Toronto the year of the strike. And I think in order to try to circumnavigate the fact that there was going to be no actors there, they took a lot of movies that were directed by actors to try to sort of get big names there as in the capacity of director instead of actor. Anna Kendrick couldn't go because she's also an actress in this movie. But
yeah,
sort of early on in the festival, or even I guess as soon as the festival lineup was announced, people were like, like probably some of these are going to be bad and wouldn't have gotten in otherwise. And so when the festival started, the first batch of them were not great, like that Pool Man or whatever from Chris Pine. And there was something from Michael Keaton. Like there was some bad movies in the mix. And so by the time the Anna Kendrick one rolled around, I was sort of like, okay, yeah, I don't need to go see one of these, like I'll go see something else. And then after the screening, everyone was like, oh, it was amazing, it's the best one, like it's so good. And I was like, okay, well, never mind then, because I missed that. So
your hatred of women lives on.
Right, I said absolutely not, male movies for me only. How come we're not getting the serial killer side of things, huh? How come he's not allowed to direct a movie? I am excited to see it. I almost went and saw it last weekend or 2 weekends ago, because it was playing at the Paris here in New York, which is Netflix's theater, and I thought, oh, this would be a fun movie to see in a theater, but then I ended up doing something else instead. I can't remember what. But anyways, okay, well, this episode has gone on way too long. We will be back on Thursday to discuss the cancer movie We Live in Time, starring Florence Pugh and Andrew Garfield. But thank you all for listening, and we'll see you guys then. Bye.